All right, to the Hall of Mammals.
To the Hall of Mammals.
To the Hall of Mammals.
Biff, bam, pow, science! Well, like a pair of nerdy wannabe superheroes that we are, Professor Jonathan Losos and I dash into Harvard's Museum of Comparative Zoology.
We just walk right over here, down the hallway.
Okay, so we actually walked, as you just heard. But Losos is the curator of herpetology here, and he studies lizards and evolution. And he's put a lot of his thinking into the new book, Improbable Destinies, Fate, Chance, and the Future of Evolution. It's an exploration of the strange and wonderful paths that evolution has taken across the planet. Wait, paths, you say? Don't you mean just one path? Because, you know, Darwin figured out survival of the fittest, species are naturally selected, yada yada yada. But Professor Losos says there's a whole lot in that yada yada yada. In fact, there are still fundamental questions about the way life evolves, such as, are the species we see today inevitabilities? Or are they just evolutionary flukes? And how about this one? If life got another chance to evolve in a similar environment, would the exact same things happen or not?
I think it all started with a scientist here at Harvard, very famous, named Stephen Jay Gould. And he coined this phrase that if you could replay the tape of life, somehow go back and start over, would you get the same outcome? And he argued, no, you would get a very different outcome. Just random, fluky events would send evolution down another path. And the outcome, as a result, would be very different. And so his argument, which was extremely influential, was that there's a role for what he called contingency, just the particular events that happen that shape the course of evolution. And so he at one point said, you know, you could replay the tape a million times and you would never get anything like humans again. But there were actually no data. This was in the 1980s. No one was studying this question. So it was all rhetoric and logic and philosophy, really. But he was so inspirational that people went out and started trying to ask the question of how predictable or repeatable is evolution. And now, 30 years later, we actually do have a lot of data. And those data give us a more nuanced view.
But what are the data, though, right? Because we only have our one evolutionary path.
That's exactly right. There's only one history. Yeah. But the data are two things. One is, as we have gotten a better and better understanding of the evolutionary tree of life, how species are related to each other, we are discovering many instances in which species that we thought were closely related, because they are very similar, actually aren't. The debate used to be which one is more common, and we now know both are common. And the real question is trying to understand why you get convergence in some cases and not others.
Can we see some examples of the convergence?
Yes, ones? Well, let's turn around. Okay. And here we're looking at an animal called the thylacine, sometimes called the Tasmanian wolf or the Tasmanian tiger. And I think most people, if they saw that and didn't know anything better, would think it's an interesting breed of dog. But it's not. It's a marsupial. It's related to kangaroos, but it adapted to have a very similar lifestyle to wolves, and it has a very similar appearance. And then if we go to the next case over, we have what's called a sugar glider. It's, again, another marsupial, but it looks just like a flying squirrel.
Yeah.
It's got the big flaps of skin, and it can glide from one tree to another. And it's, again, done the exact same thing as the flying squirrel, but it is a marsupial. So marsupials, many of them have evolved convergently with their parallel forms in the rest of the world that are not marsupials.
We still have the duckbill platypus type one-offs,
well,
though, right?
Well, that's what it comes down to, is the debate has come down to the convergent evolution crowd having this long, enormous list of examples of convergent evolution, but the other side could make just as long a list of things that haven't converged.
So on that, let me ask you, I mean, this is just wandering into the realm of pure hypothesis, but, you know, given the fact that when DNA sorts itself, you can have an infinite number of combinations, right, in the random assortment of genes. So is what we know about genetics these days, does that help us understand that perhaps there is something to the notion that you, of what Stephen Jay Gould was talking about, that you could have all sorts of different outcomes because there are an infinite number of ways that genes can mix themselves?
Yes, and as we're now able to sequence genomes, people are actually drilling down and finding the actual genetic basis of convergence. And one of the very interesting findings is that in some cases, even distantly related species will have the exact same mutation leading to the same adaptive response. So sometimes the convergence goes down to the genetic level, But in many cases, it doesn't. In many cases, they evolve the same feature, the same phenotype, as we call it, the same external feature. But when you look at the genes, they've done it through different genetic changes.
That is fascinating.
Yeah, it's fabulous.
That is super fascinating. What does... I always have to take it out to outer space. What does this mean for... If there were an Earth-like planet out there,
well, this is
would we end up with humanoids?
Well, Hollywood thinks so. And there are some people, based on this idea of convergent evolution, on the idea that the environment poses particular challenges and that natural selection finds the same answers, that argue that life on other planets will look very similar to life here, so much so that some people claim that humanoid-type individuals with species with higher intelligence will occur on those planets. I'm dubious. As I just told you, the extent to which convergence occurs, the more distantly related species are, the less likely they are to evolve in the same way, to adapt in the same way. And of course, you couldn't be more distantly related than an independent life form on another planet. It's much more likely that completely different ways of adapting would evolve.
Right. And we also can't tell sort of what the dominant pressures in the environment were. There's got to be a whole mix of them at any particular time.
Exactly. And in fact, one of the things that biologists are very clear about these days is that a lot of the natural selection pressures come from other species.
Yeah. I mean, well, changing it because of the pressure of different species, it makes me think of the pressures that humankind is putting on the planet and what effect that has on how life is evolving.
That's absolutely true. And that's, you know, the other thing I talk about in my book is that one of the things that Darwin got wrong, and someone just told me, no, you can't say Darwin got something wrong, but the fact is he thought that evolution occurs extremely slowly. Well, we now know that's wrong. We know that when natural selection pressures are strong, populations can adapt extremely quickly, quickly enough to see over a couple of years' time. And so that means that what we're doing to this planet now, changing the world in so many ways, well, it's an inadvertent evolution experiment. We are subjecting species to new conditions, and we will see if they can adapt to them, and if so, how.
It's very sobering.
Well, it's, you know...
I mean, it's happening, but it's also very sobering.
It is sobering, but also exciting in a way. Evolution turns out to be very relevant to the here and now, that understanding how it occurs will tell us how and whether species can adapt.
This is so great. We could spend the whole day in here.
Yeah,
but
no
I feel
doubt.
Like we should talk about lizards.
All right. We're going to go back this way. So now we're going to descend into the bowels of the Museum of Comparative Zoology.
Wow. Wow.
Okay, so this room is full of specimens of lizards. It's one of the greatest collections of lizard specimens in the world.
I mean, are we looking at thousands and thousands of specimen jars here?
Yes, we are. This is just like a library with one of these rolling shelves, so it's very economical in squeezing them all in. But as you'll see, there are just jar after jar documenting the diversity of lizards of the world.
Wow. So how did you fall in love with lizards?
Well, I mean, like many children, it started with dinosaurs. I was fascinated with dinosaurs as a little boy. And, you know, this was back in the 1960s where, you know, I read books, I had the plastic animals, I loved dinosaurs. And then as I got older, of course, dinosaurs aren't around, except for birds, we now know, but that didn't really count. So I became fascinated with living reptiles. And a particularly important event in my life when I was about 10 or 11 was convincing my mother to let me get a baby caiman, which is a South American relative of the alligator. And I got them as pets, and they were nasty little animals, but fascinating.
So what did your lobbying effort include to convince your mother?
Well, so I'd gotten the idea from an episode of Leave It to Beaver, which I don't know if kids these days know Leave It to Beaver, but a classic television show where the beaver had ordered a baby alligator from Captain Jack's alligator farm and smuggled it into his house, and his mother didn't know about it, and hilarity ensues. So I got the idea. I knew that pet stores sold caimans, and I asked my mother, and my mother is not the sort of woman who likes to say no. So instead she said, we'll ask Mr. Hessel, the at that time deputy director of the St. Louis Zoo, what he thinks. And my mom was counting on Mr. Hessel putting the kibosh on the idea. And so I bugged my father. He was a family friend, I should say. I bugged my father for several weeks. And finally, one day, my dad comes home and he says, well, I spoke with Mr. Hessel and he said it's a great idea. That's how he got his start in zoology. And so my mom was stuck. And so we went and got a Cayman. And then she went back and bought a second one because she felt bad that it was lonely. Which was, you know, I doubt that caimans get lonely. But anyway, so I had two caimans, and they were, they're nasty little animals. Alligators, it turns out, are quite docile and make reasonable pets. But caimans have a nastier disposition. So you had to be careful when we handled them.
Wow. I mean, I feel like we've talked to so many scientists now that this is a unifying thing, that in their background there was always someone who either couldn't say no or said, try it. That's a great idea.
Absolutely.
And they were going. Then we were headed down the road to more science.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, I guess a part of me wants to know what you think is the craziest lizard species you've got here.
That is a fighting word. Which one? The craziest lizard species. Well, we do have some big guys, but should we look in the tank?
Yes,
do you want to
see? Right. I'd love to.
Okay, we're taking off the lid.
Whoa!
And here we go. A bunch of Nile monitors. They're found throughout the continent. This is a species that has a very long whip-like tail. They can get 5 feet, maybe 6 feet long. These ones
look to be balled up.
Yeah. They're all balled up. So let's take a look at one of them. So it's a pretty, if we stretch this guy out, I bet he would be 5 feet long. These are fabulous lizards. These are certainly among the best ones.
What is it that lizards, I mean, this is a very broad question, but what is it that lizards have to teach us?
Well, number one, they're great survivors. They were around at the time of the dinosaurs, and increasingly we're finding very cool fossils of lizards going way back in time. And they're incredibly diverse. Right now, there are about 10,000 species of lizards in the world today, occupying almost any habitat you can imagine on land. They don't get to the far north and far south because it's too cold, but otherwise they're all over the place. And in some areas, you'll find more lizards than you find mammals or birds.
Okay, so the last question I have. Do we know why T-Rex had such short arms?
Do we? That is a great question. The T-Rex had these...
My 7-year-old is dying to know.
These ridiculously little arms for its body size. And, I mean, this highlights both the excitement of evolutionary biology and the frustration. Because, of course, T-Rex has been gone for 66 million years. There's nothing like it today. How do we figure out what its arms are for? And there are lots of ideas. And some of these ideas are kind of crazy. One idea is that it evolved particularly short arms to make sure it didn't bite them off in a feeding frenzy. That seems kind of ridiculous.
Yes.
Other people have argued that they did little T-Rex push-ups and they were taking a nap and they needed to roll over and push off the ground. Their little arms would push them off the ground. Now, I'm not sure why little arms would be useful then, but some scientists propose that. Or maybe that the male used the two claws, they only had two fingers, to titillate the female in courtship. These ideas are all in the scientific literature. If only we could do an experiment, get a bunch of theropod dinosaurs, put them on little continents, and come back a million years later and see what happens.
Maybe. There was a movie like that. Didn't turn out well.
Yeah, maybe someday.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. This has been absolutely a joy and fascinating, and I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Well, my pleasure.
Jonathan Losos is curator of herpetology at Harvard's Museum of Comparative Zoology. His new book is Improbable: Destinies, Fate, Chance, and the Future of Evolution. This is Radio Boston.